history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, pretty incredible stories, stories that will get your attention, that may even inspire you. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we really are educated, we're entertained, and yeah, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada with 94-year-old Roger Bain, originally from northern Wisconsin. What's your hometown in Wisconsin, Roger?
Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It's north central. It'd be north of Wausau. 40 miles. It's only 8 or 9,000 people. They had a big paper mill there. Of course, that's timber country. It's always been.
And a fair amount of snow in the winter, I imagine.
And cold weather. Yeah. I seen 40 below up there.
40 below. Ooh. Well, I guess that was just preparing you for the Battle of the Bulge, which we're going to hear about as well. But growing up there, you and your sister and your family in northern Wisconsin, what are the things you remember about your childhood? I imagine it's a little different from what kids experience today.
Of course, born so early, 1925, that's horse and buggy days and Model Ts. So. And very few roads that's blacktopped or something. Being up there, they was building a power dam hydro plant on the Wisconsin River. My dad was building it. And we lived out in the country where it's primitive living. There was nothing, no fancy stuff. Your car was a Model T. And you lived out in the country because the dam wasn't near towns. You lived out in the woods. And it was very primitive country.
Did you have a refrigerator?
What was that?
No such thing, huh?
No such thing. No electricity.
No electricity.
No, they didn't know so far out. It was on the river. That was, they picked that spot because it was a place to back up water for a dam.
That's why he was building the dam, so yeah. Electricity could come to that area.
Yeah.
So what'd you do for lighting around the house?
At that time?
Yeah.
Lamps.
Oil lamps, huh?
Oil, yeah. Uh-huh.
And how'd you stay warm in the winter?
Wood heat. Of course, I was only a baby, you know. I didn't know nothing about that wood heating anything.
Well, I bet you got chopping wood pretty young.
Not really. I didn't do any chopping wood. After the dam was finished, my dad, we went to lived in Rhinelander then, and he worked at the power company for that.
You moved into town once the dam was finished.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, they had electricity and lights.
A whole new world.
But we didn't have no refrigerators either.
Icebox?
Icebox. And they had a trailer that I lived in. They made ice boxes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they made ice on the river. They had a Floyd there. They made ice and put them in big buildings, stored sawdust on them to keep the ice from melting. And then they delivered it with horse and buggy, horse and wagon to houses.
Mm-hmm.
They'd chop it up in small pieces and bring it to your ice box.
A different world, to be sure. And your father had been wounded in World War One.
Yeah.
Did he ever tell you much about his service overseas?
Never said nothing.
Could you see the physical effects of his injuries, or you just knew
that was... No, he never showed him or anything. Never said nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Never talked about it.
So how did you know that he had been wounded in World War One? You saw his Purple Heart, or what?
I got his Purple Heart. He was in three campaigns. He's in the 3rd Division.
Well, and obviously, if... his injuries had been worse if he didn't make it home from World War One. You would have never been born.
Yeah.
But here you are growing up with your sister. Do you remember as that young man having some idea of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life? Did you have some ambitions like that?
Well, I come out of high school and I put in the service. From then on, I went into the electrical trade. And that's where I was for the next 44 years.
And I'm just curious, having just listened to just a few minutes of your life story here, was your interest in electrical work, did that have anything to do with that dam project and the fact that you...
Well, my dad was a line foreman at the power company. As a little kid, I grew up with all those guys he worked with. At that time, they was young men, you know? And I grew up amongst them, so I kind of fit in with them. I was the first hire they had after World War II, you know.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I knew them guys. They all knew me. And
that makes sense.
I kind of fit in.
So you said as soon as you turned 18, you joined the Army. But I'm curious about before that. If I do the math, you would have been 16 and a half when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Sure.
Where were you? How'd you find out?
I was walking downtown and come out somewhere, and I just, he's like, oh, it's a surprise.
So you were walking downtown and some people came by and were...
Yeah, there's other people. And, hey, what's going on, you know? That's a surprise. I finished high school and I went to service.
Well, how did things change at your high school or in your hometown after Pearl Harbor? Could you notice a difference?
Not really.
Were there any of the students leaving for the service right then?
Oh, yeah. Well, the guys was already going into the 32nd Division that had the company there. All the guys that belonged to it was gone, leaving. Of course, they went to South Pacific.
Yeah, the Red Arrow Division.
Yeah.
They went to New Guinea and the Philippines.
Yeah, 32nd.
And I'm sure you knew some of those guys pretty well.
Oh, sure. I knew a lot of them.
And this may or may not be applicable, but I'm just thinking about some of the other stories I've heard from so many veterans in a situation like that where you're not old enough to go yet, unless you lie about your age and trick somebody. Were there situations while you're still in school, but you're hearing about someone from your hometown who'd been killed or wounded overseas?
Oh, yeah. I knew some of them. And a fellow by the name of Macris, the veterans post was named after him. He was the first guy killed.
Yeah, if you were to visit Rhineland or Wisconsin today, you'd find the Dahlberg Macris Post 7 of the American Legion, named for Abner Dahlberg, who was killed in World War I, and Peter Macris, who was a year ahead of Roger in high school there. Peter Macris was aboard the USS Houston, a light cruiser which was sunk by the Japanese in the Battle of Sunda Strait in the early morning hours of March 1, 1942. Of the more than 1,000 men aboard, only 368 survived, only to be captured and taken to Japanese prison camps. 77 of them died in captivity, and the world never knew what really happened to the Houston and her crew until after the war when those prisoners were liberated. Peter Macris was one of those who was lost in the battle, the first from Rhinelander, Wisconsin, to be killed in World War II.
And I do a lot of guys that was killed, too.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 16, 17-year-old kid, and you find out, hey, this guy that I was seeing in the hall at school every day just got killed in this war.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would make me want to sign up.
Well, everybody else was. Hey, I'm going to go too. Everybody else is going.
And what was the motivation there? Because I've heard a lot of veterans discuss this, and I don't know if it's something that in our day and age is easy for everyone to identify. I don't know if the same kind of spirit or sentiment exists in our country. Can you help us understand why that was so important to you to go out there and fight for our country?
Well, it's a kind of a foolish thing to say, but you're just a dumb kid. That's a funny thing. It was going to go. I had no qualms about it. I went to the service. It didn't bother me going to the service. I didn't find no problems with being in the service, training and all that stuff. Kind of thought it was a little foolish at times, but I went into service with there's four of us, and we was all in our serial numbers in rotation. The last two numbers was in the 30s. Mine was 34, and our name in rotation. I'm the only one left alive. They all died from old age.
Yeah, they made it through the war.
Yeah, but they made it through the war, too.
You know, you just shared about your feelings and why you wanted to be in the service and everyone else was doing it. But how did your mom and dad feel about you enlisting?
It wasn't too pleased, though. No, they didn't think too highly of it. But my guy's going to have to go. He's going to go. That's it. And, of course, I didn't think much of it, you know. So I went to service, put the time in, and I come home. And early in the morning, before daylight, it's my uniform. I got to sneak home, you know. I stepped up to get off this train, and there's my mother and dad smiling at me. I was going to sneak home.
You thought you'd pull a fast one on him, huh?
But the newspaper was publishing when the guys was coming home, and I think they was meeting the train a few days before, waiting for me.
Oh, you think that wasn't the first time they were there?
I think so. They didn't say nothing.
So what did that feel like when you got off the train after everything you'd been through and you see them standing there?
Oh, God. You say, oh, geez, now what? But they was happy, proud of me. It didn't mean much to me, you know. I'm home.
But you could see what it meant to them.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why your emotions are getting stirred right now a little bit.
Yeah.
I can tell. Sure. Well, and just another question. I'm sorry if any of my questions seem a little odd. In reference to so many other vets I've talked to, a lot of guys, if they didn't wait to be drafted, one of the reasons they enlisted was they wanted to go in the Marine Corps or in the Navy, or maybe they wanted to fly. But you signed up for the regular Army.
Yeah, I went into the regular Army.
Why was that your choice? What was it about the Army that you said, hey, I want to be a part of that?
Well, I didn't want to go on no airship. I want to go. And the Marines, they're glorified infantry.
And you were fine with regular infantry?
Yeah. No, oh. That's good enough for me. I wasn't afraid of the service.
Just thinking again about the uniqueness of your story, with your father having served in the infantry in World War I, did he have any advice for you before you went off to boot camp?
No, he didn't say a word. He's hoping I'd get into something else, like driving a truck or something.
Uh-huh.
One day, I think the guys interviewed me and said, well, here's the dumb kid who was sent him in the infantry.
Well, what was your welcome to the Army like? Was it what you expected when you went to your basic training?
Yeah, and after I got there a couple of weeks, I could see what they're... The idea was to train you, to they could maneuver you around, and they would treat you kind of poorly, you know. They had all kinds of reasons to make life miserable for you. But I thought, I'd learn to keep your mouth shut and stay out of sight.
Where did they send you for your training?
It's outside of Little Rock, Arkansas.
All right.
Sorry, country. That's where I got introduced to chiggers.
Ooh.
Bugs around your waist that bite on you.
Well, and I guess I should ask, too, and I'm sorry I'm bouncing around time-wise here, but growing up in northern Wisconsin, there's a lot of hunting that happens there, partly just to survive. You've got to feed yourself.
I did a lot of it.
So you were a pretty good shot when you went in the Army.
Oh, yeah, I shot a lot of deer.
Uh-huh.
Partridges and ducks. I was introduced to shooting when I was pretty small. Yeah, just did a lot of shooting. I had a pretty good shot. And, of course, I didn't have to buy the ammunition. It was an M1 rifle. I didn't mind shooting it.
A little better weapon than what you were using back home, huh?
Oh, yeah.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas and meeting the enemy in combat?
Well, they had no experience. They put me on this boat they called the Ile de France. And I thought, geez, that's a big ship. That's a big one. 2 days later, I never had such a small boat in all my life. The other guys are sick. Seasick. I didn't understand that.
And where did you land in Europe?
I landed in England, and we went across the channel. I sat several days on some old tug, old boat that's run by Indians from India. I lived on bread and water. Of course, that's their food. My unit landed on D+4.
4 days after D-Day. Pretty early on.
4 or 5 days after D-Day, yeah.
Which beach did you come into?
Omaha Beach.
Omaha Beach. So just a few days before you got there, this is one of the...
It was all over with. The landing was over with.
But I'm sure there's some evidence of what had happened there that's greeting you.
Well, it was cleaned up pretty well, you know. All there was is material we had run in. And went up, got into trucks, and where are you going? I'm going to go to the 3rd Division.
So when you came ashore at Omaha Beach, were there any sights or sounds or smells that gave you the...
It was cleaned up. It was cleaned up. The dead bodies was gone, and everything was like the normal, that it was already inland.
And you're in a rifle platoon?
Infantry rifle platoon.
So all of a sudden, you're going to be in this unit where you're depending on guys you've never met before.
Nobody knew me, and you got in so after a while, you got just like the rest of them. You didn't really want to get real friendly with anybody because you didn't know how long they would last. That was a hardest part of being in infantry.
Hmm.
And then you get there a long time, and you see the other fellows are gone. Then you say, when is it my turn? And you get a little nervous.
Understandably so. Over the 11 months that followed, the 30th Infantry Division would suffer over 18,000 casualties. What was the situation that would leave Roger Bain with a Purple Heart, just like his father's from World War I? And how close was he to the infamous Malmedy Massacre? We'll find out when we come back. Find photos and a short video of Roger online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.